We hear next the fourth in a series of panels from the Gay Academic Union Conference. This panel is on lesbian aesthetics. It was held at NYU's Loeb Student Center on November 29th and 30th, 1974. The panelists are Beth Hodges, Bertha Harris, Gail Rubin, and Rita Mae Brown.
When I began thinking in October about lesbianism in literary art, I had two assumptions. First, that aesthetics is subjective, psychological. That beauty is a quality not of the work, but rather of the response to the work. Second, that on the basis of my response, I could generalize about the lesbian response. I still hold that beauty is subjective, but I doubt that I can make universally valid statements about the lesbian response to art. Rather, I plan to give an account of my thoughts, my criticism of those thoughts, and to make some speculative observations. In October, I was thinking about the question of lesbian aesthetics, reading a great deal, works that were interesting to me, and works that I had to read for courses I was teaching. I was writing notes to myself, thoughts about the lesbian aesthetic. My first observations were general and absolute. My principles were, phallic is ugly, lesbian is beautiful, self-determined woman is beautiful, relationships between women is beautiful. These principles were the result of gut-level reactions to phallic literature. I had not yet questioned their validity. In October, I read The First Sex by Elizabeth Gould Davis. According to Davis, woman is the true type of the species, the first type and the innately superior. Jealous of the woman's superiority and hating his inessentiality, man by brute force overthrew the original order, the matriarchy, and substituted his own destructive and inhuman values. And his story is the record of the subjugation of woman through all of his institutions, law, government, marriage, the family, religion, education. Now, whether or not woman was in fact the first sex is irrelevant to me. The importance of Davis's book was that it freed me of an absolutist view of society and the authority of the patriarchal institutions. I admit the power and the tyranny of man's institutions. The power and the tyranny exist, but I deny their necessity, their goodness and rightness, their divine origin. It is a man's world, that's a fact of our life, but I deny that this man's world is necessary, just, kind, good, beautiful, divinely authorized, ideal. I deny that it is humane in an ideal sense. With this vision of society as a brutal, barbaric, oppressive, destructive, inhuman, or infeminine, artificial male construct, I read the Iliad. I read the Iliad and I was outraged. It reflects so well the stupidity and barbarity of man's activities and the emptiness of his values. In retaliation for not being essential, man has subjugated woman. Man has defined property and occupies himself defending it. In the Iliad, defense of property leads to war. Men destroy in battle and call themselves glorious for their destruction. So what's new? Man is still claiming property, territory, wealth, women, children, still creating governments, monopolies, founding dynasties, creating financial empires, begetting sons to inherit the name, the fame, the property. That's the activity of man and his raison d'etre. Honor and glory are pitiful concepts man invented to dignify his destructive and inhuman activity. The background of the Iliad is that a Trojan, Paris, has abducted Helen, the wife of a Greek, Menelaus. The Greeks rallied to help Menelaus recover his property. Ostensibly, the war is fought over Helen, but Helen is not the appeal. At the time of the action of the Iliad, Helen has been sitting in the palace at Troy for 19 years weaving. Women aren't even interesting. The appeal of Helen is that whoever is married to her stands to succeed Helen's father as king of Sparta. I read along in the Iliad, furious that a man, Homer, has Helen tell how disgusting that she is, that she, the property of a Greek, gave herself to a Trojan. But when I came to the scene between Hector and Andromache, I became outraged. Andromache tells Hector how her mother and seven brothers had been killed by a Greek and how her mother had been taken captive and was ransomed only to die. Andromache asks Hector to refrain from battle, that she not lose him, who is father and mother, brother and husband to her, and that their child might not be left an orphan. Hector answers that he knows he will die and she will be taken captive, but to hell with you and the child. To hell with protecting you from other destructive and property-claiming men. My honor is my identity. And he says, I have learned to be valiant and to fight always among the foremost ranks of the Trojans, winning for my own self great glory. Then he says this incredible thing, that what grieves him is that the great Hector's property not the person Andromache, will be reduced to slavery, and that she will be grieved that the mighty Hector who could have saved her will be dead. And he says, someday, seeing you shedding tears, a man will say of you, this is the wife of Hector, who was ever the bravest fighter of the Trojans. And for you, it will be yet a fresh grief to be widowed of such a man who could have, who could fight off the day of your slavery. A fine consolation for Andromache that Hector goes off to kill himself so she could be a captive, and he goes off to distinguish himself so as to raise her value as captive property. I read this, and I'm outraged. I wish to reject all male literature. I'm angry that I was blind and stupid enough not to have noticed the abomination the phallic world is and its reflections in literature. I'm angry that I collaborated in this man's world, spent my life reading and studying and teaching man's literature. I wish to reject all literature which reflects the phallic world, to admit only literature which, if it does reflect the phallic world, stands as a criticism of male values and activities. Now my question is, what is beautiful? This is all a stage I was in, right? You understand? Yeah. Okay. What I find beautiful is not what men find beautiful, defining and defending property, celebrating their honor, their manhood, the worthlessness of women, writing histories, celebrating man's feats, man's conquests, writing literature that celebrates the patriarchal values. I wish to see an image of the woman-defined woman, the woman independent of man for her definitions, the self-determined woman. I wish to see a woman-centered literature, an image of the woman as moral instigator, making her choices, creating her own definitions, solving for herself her unique problems, creating herself and her own world. I wish to read about relationships between women, to see celebrated relationships between equals, between women who respect each other as they respect themselves. This was my progress, violent rejection of male written literature, uncritical acceptance of lesbian-authored literature, desire for images of woman-defined woman, and for descriptions of relationships between women. But my definitions proved inadequate. I found so many exceptions to my principles that I'm forced to abandon my first thoughts. I rejected male literature. But this is not and hardly can be a principle of the lesbian aesthetic. I told the lesbian feminist PhD candidate in literature of my reaction to the Iliad. She told me that the phallic view did not spoil her pleasure in reading the Iliad. Soon after this conversation, I held a creative writing class for one of my colleagues, and I realized that I can be pleased by things men write. Falling down a spiral of thanksgiving does not offend me. I know what that is, too. The same student, Rex Vandewage, talked of weeding the garden and having difficulty distinguishing weeds from the tomato plants. That's universal, common to no one sex, no one sexuality, no one culture, and it pleased me as it probably would have pleased anyone. And how can I reject wholesale the Western tradition of literature when my pleasure in reading Bertha Harris's Confessions of Cherubino is in part my pleasure in recognizing and admiring the echoing of that tradition in the moment she has created? How can I toss out Western civilization? If I weren't familiar with Euripides and classical myth, the Bible, medieval legend, Beaumarchais, Mozart, surrealism, Faulkner, and the Southern literary tradition, my appreciation of Confessions of Cherubino would be impoverished. I said I wanted a literature.
I feel better.
You do. I called for images of woman-defined woman. My questions are then, are all images of woman-defined woman equally positive and equally pleasing? What of literature like poetry in which the primary aim is not development of character? And doesn't the possibility exist that a positive image of a woman-defined woman might be pleasing to a non-lesbian too? I said I wanted a literature that described relationships between women. But there are all sorts of relationships between women, just as there are all sorts of works authored by lesbians, and just as there are all sorts of images of woman-defined woman. There are relationships between women that reproduce the male-female, master-slave, explorative relationships of the larger society. And there are responsible, loving, tender relationships between women who approach each other as equals. Some relationships are more pleasing than others. But how can I say that only descriptions of positive relationships please? That's false. There is the pleasure of recognition. Recognition of the truth about our lives, the harsh and ugly truth as well as the agreeable. And I have another question. If we're talking about descriptions of positive love relationships, isn't it the quality of the love relationship that pleases rather than the sex of the participants? Would only lesbians find pleasing the relationship between Ellen and Margaret in Confessions of Cherubino? And do lesbians not find pleasing some relationships between male and female? The same lesbian feminist PhD candidate in literature I mentioned before said that the most beautiful movie she ever saw was Summer of 42. The... Well, she said that the innocence and tenderness of that boy was her innocence and tenderness at that same age. Which brings me to a turning point. Lesbian subject matter may contribute to the pleasure the lesbian receives from the work, but lesbian subject matter seems neither to guarantee nor to be an absolute condition of the lesbian's aesthetic response to work. Why have I been discussing content and ignoring the essential, the medium? Can we identify a lesbian response to a medium? Do we react in a distinct manner to a medium of art? I will use the example of black and white photography rather than literature because with photography, it is simpler to separate the medium from the content. There are certain things photography is capable of, contrast of light and dark, of textures, depth of feel, and the formal ordering of visual elements. We demand from photography the pleasures that are proper to photography, not the pleasures that are proper to an audio medium, for example. Photography has its particular limitations and its particular powers of pleasing. In other words, it's the nature of the medium that dictates the medium's potential for pleasing. Is there a lesbian manner of organizing visual elements? Is there a lesbian appreciation of visual composition? I don't think so. The question of content aside, is there something unique in the lesbian's perception of a photograph? If there is, it is no more discoverable than an answer to the question of whether what we identify as green looks the same to you as it does to me. I'm remembering now what I read a very long time ago about African art. The African had nothing Western man could identify as art because of Western man's definition of art. For Western man, art is a product, an object, a thing out there, separate from the maker. Something that could be put in a museum or on a library shelf or hung on a wall, valued because it could be owned, valued because it was property one can buy or sell or steal. For the African, art, if we can call it that, is process. There is no art apart from the making. Art is dynamic. It is the doing. The act of creating is the art, the putting together of words or of drumbeats. If the activity results in a product, should an image result from the carving of the wood, the product is tossed, for the object has no value. Beauty is a force, a living spirit. One doesn't capture beauty, it's the other way around. Beauty is the spirit that possesses the creator while she is hewing the rock, carving the wood, beating the drum, crying her chant. Beauty is a force that participates in a process or an activity. There is no way that beauty, a force, can lodge in an object. Only the act, the process, can be full of the spirit. The result of the act, the object, is without life, without spirit, without meaning, without value. The rock or the wood, when the activity is finished, is no more or less than a rock or a piece of wood slightly battered. Today in the United States, the blacks have a non-Western medium, jive. In relation to jive, it is possible to recognize a black aesthetic. Cecil Brown, in The Philosophy of Jive, talks about the white way of looking at the world, distinguishing subject from the object, the observer from the observed, the internal world from the external world. But jive, he says, is seeing the whole thing as one. There is no discrepancy between the internal and external world. One can be made to form the other. A passionate mind can make the world passionate for all of us. Force, a strong mind can make the outcome to whatever that mind is. In literature, to write is right from one point specifically. Not so with which is the literary form of rap. Jive is digression, except you never leave the point. You understand that, don't you? Jive is the ultimate consciousness. Jive is not just style, it is the style. Style for the sake of style, which, to tell the truth, is the only style. We can recognize a black aesthetic in relation to a black medium. but can we distinguish a unique black appreciation of a Western art medium? I said this, but I didn't make my point very clear. What I'm saying is that, well, I call this a black aesthetic, but it's not really a black aesthetic either, because black doesn't have anything to do with appreciation of the medium. You know, there are people, you don't have to be black to appreciate it, and if you practice a non-Western medium, then you're appreciating another aesthetic. You understand what I mean? I'm talking about people who practice the novel as defined by, you know, the Western tradition. Then that's not a black aesthetic. I mean, you don't take a black... Oh, well, anyway. Okay. Can we distinguish a unique black appreciation of a Western art medium, a unique lesbian appreciation, or a unique Hindu appreciation? I think that special interest appreciations don't exactly exist, because I think the medium is more important. I don't think so. As long as we're considering as art the traditional Western art forms, as long as we're talking about the novel, the poem, the painting, the sculpture, the photograph, as long as we're talking about products, objects out there, we're going to be talking about the same old aesthetic. I don't think lesbians do demand or can demand anything unique. I'm still talking aside from content. But if we were to recognize our medium, if we were to recognize that we are our art, to be a lesbian is to improvise. We are not following anybody's score. We are creating ourselves, and our creations are all valid, all beautiful. This summer I wrote a poem celebrating woman in process, and it's dedicated to all of us. Woman, creating woman, creating woman, creating, creating woman, creating woman, creating woman, creating, woman, creating woman. I meant to celebrate woman, celebrate being woman, celebrate woman improvising, woman becoming. I meant not to define creating. Creating is all of us everywhere doing whatever we see to be authentic, being our art. It is Jill Johnston writing those fantastically weird, wonderful columns. It is Dolores and Deborah establishing an activist organization at Kent State. It is Julia Stanley declaring her independence of the oppressive university system. It is Carla J. reviewing and anthologizing. It is Jean and Laurel putting together magazines. It is Bertha Harris writing books that make me sing. It is Elaine Noble running for office in Boston. It is Rita Mae Brown telling tough truths. It is Claudia getting it together in San Francisco. It is Laurie in Kansas preparing to make a new world after the collapse of this one. It is Barbara and Charlotte and Chris and Dee Dee and Muriel wherever she is. It is everyone linking us with each other. It is all of us talking and thinking and writing and loving and caring and responding and providing models and seeking solutions and laughing and ditching and teaching and refusing to teach and being positive and being unsure and being militant and seeking a separate peace and reaching out and waiting, hoping to be reached. It is all of us everywhere, being, doing, becoming, creating ourselves in the image of the lesbian. To paraphrase a French philosopher, every lesbian is an artist. What she creates is herself.
That's provoked by what talks are given, what papers are presented, will be kept to the end, and Bertha Harris will be our next speaker.
I swear there's no collusion between me and Beth Hodges, but...
I'm glad you didn't go first, because I thought I was going to be saying the same thing you said.
It's going to be more or less a day for the Greeks, apparently. What I've got here is basically a working definition for a much longer, hopefully a book of essays that are more or less the first time I'm going to try to objectify things that I have sort of subjectified in fiction. I don't know whether to say one work I think I'm going to refer to at least indirectly is Euripides the Bacchae, and since that gentleman has already been introduced into our midst, I'm going to have to assume your familiarity with the work because of the shortness of time, and because it is more or less an outline of something longer, some of the points I make may not may need some clarification, and if that's the case, I'll be glad to later on. As a preamble to this paper, I would like to say that I believe aesthetics is born without exception as a result of a conjunction between the mind and the heart of the erotic imagination. And point number two, that sexual preference, also without exception, is an inalienable human right and is also born of the erotic imagination. But it seems to me that much of the confusion, and I dare say anguish, which has visited so many of us since the advent of the gay revolution, has been caused by well-intentioned but occasionally extraordinarily mistaken efforts to weld to the machinery of social change the expression of the erotic. A perverse union as insufferable as its previous expression in that fine and private place, the closet. To transgress against eroticism in this manner, to put it to the service of social bias, is to profane the sexual and, in consequence, divest it of its life-giving, art-making powers. I'm going to have to cut as I go along because this is much too long, but anyway. There has been more nonsense, I would guess, expressed on the subject of art than on any other, excluding perhaps those of sex and religion. Or possibly not excluding the latter two subjects, since both of these areas of human experience have been identified as essential components of the creative activity, since we first delivered ourselves over to the impulse to make a thing which is, in its final utterance, both a phenomenon of the self and distinct from the self. While there is nothing inherently wrong with this description of work, of the work-making process, wrongness has historically emanated from it, primarily, I believe, in the following ways. That the intellectual process of art-making is analogous to the generative event in the womb which produces a child. And number two, that the first enterprise is exclusively male, and while the second is inescapably female. And thirdly, that the biological mother-child event, although it involves no participation of the intellect, is a creative act for the woman equal to but separate from the creative act of making art. These are, of course, distortions which we all by now recognize as distortions, but they have their genesis in an ancient but implacable misinterpretation of the nature of mimesis, and an even more, even greater misinterpretation, I believe, of the nature of the god Dionysus, both of which have caused, I believe, a disastrous assignment of gender to areas of human behavior where none was originally intended. Like Athena, we have all sprung in our various cultural lineaments from the Olympian necessities of Father Zeus in the enactment of that rite called mimesis, the imitation of alien characteristics. The simple storyline of the myth, without delving too far back into the hazardous fogs of matriarchal vision, begins in medias res on Mount Olympus. Zeus, as was his habit and privilege, has impregnated a mortal maiden named Semele. She bears a son, half divine, half mortal, named Dionysus. Dionysus grows with his mother into the vigorous spirit of the Kouros, the young initiate, at which point Zeus destroys Semele and calls his son to him to be, and I quote Father Zeus, to be born again from this my male womb. In so doing, he gives Dionysus a new name, a new aspect, a new persona. Come, O Dithyrambos, he calls, be born again from this my male womb. And the second birth, mimesis, is accomplished. The accumulative disclosures of the second birth are obvious, that the first maternal birth was inadequate to the making of a fully grown being, and that the rebirth of the son from the father is the most potent symbol we have of the spirit of the patriarchy. The union of father and son, of male and with male, in a sexually exclusive situation of power and privilege. I have to get my breath. But most important, for our purposes here, the mimetic rite is the original demonstration of how art is made, For the name dithyrambos is the name of our first art form, at least in Western society, the name of tragedy. We are faced then with a division between the male creative agent and the female nurturing agent, between those who can make art and those who cannot. And from this we can observe another primary aspect of the myth, its recognition of the fact that childbearing is not a creative act for the woman, it is a creative act for the child itself, who uses the mother as a passive vehicle through which it forces itself into birth. Such is a general condition of womankind, as the myth expresses it, has expressed it. It is only in the second birth that the child bearer and the child become equally active participants in the event. There is then, I believe, something apparently wrong with the definition of mimesis. Since the mother is not a creative agent at the first birth, hold this up. Since the mother is not a creative agent at the first birth, and since the father is at the second, then mimesis is not an imitation of the alien, but a creation of the new. The mother at the first birth is incapable of shaping birth, and the father must become, because of the means of the patriarchy, the stimulus of the second birth. Recognizing the magnitude of the birth event, the father steals it, makes it his own. He makes something, an active verb. But the nature of Dionysus before the second birth is also valuable to the patriarchal aesthetic principle. Previously, Dionysus has been symbolically and culturally inseparable from the figure of the mother. Indeed, it is from this alliance that the great nature of ecstasy associated with the god and with art is expressed. And further, it is this elementary union with the female which indicates the androgynous nature of the god to us, a matter which I will shortly pursue. The myth has until now been made to state that in the formation of the aesthetic, the denial of the female is essential, an invaluable weapon for the patriarchy. However, it has not been able to render entirely invisible that model of generation. What it has done is to take woman's most noticeable function and to denigrate it into an inchoate mass of magic from which terror, masculine science releases us, the ultimate weapon of the patriarchy, founded, of course, on heterosexual principle. The truth of the myth, however, is that neither the mother of the first birth nor the father of the second are the actual operatives. It is the child and the independent action, energy, and purpose of the child, both as biological fact and as metaphor, that is the genuine key to the nature of both human birth and human creativity. Although nursed in the cradle of heterosexual influence, however it chooses to render itself, the child makes itself happen. While the concept of birth, therefore, cannot be omitted from the conceptualization of art making, I believe that we can, in brief now, acknowledge two things about the myth. That the model for art making is the activity of the child, but not that of the mother nor the father. And that, too, it is impossible for woman qua woman or man qua man to make art. Because woman, by virtue of gender, cannot participate in either the original or in the mimetic event, woman is, throughout the inescapable logic of the myth, also prevented from activity as a creative agent, that material structuring of the aesthetic known as art. In the first birth, woman's role is that of nurturing, supportive, passive womb. In the second, the, quote, male womb of the father, although it, too, is secondary to the child, again, because of the special needs of the patriarchy, is the stimulating agent for adulthood, power, creative activity. But for women generally, it has been a case of seduced and abandoned, of course, as is popularly called. How men have benefited from the situation is visible all around us. The solution I shall propose for the lesbian artist, and I'm going to use lesbian sort of as a code name for artists here, I believe that the myth was originally intended for the lesbian, and I hope to get to that. Yeah. Woman, again, woman in general, cannot simply dismiss the control of the myth by pretending it has lost its potency, by pointing to the multitude of women artists. Because of the myth, women have made art in spite of the myth, and in so doing exhibit a rebellious spirit against authority for which they should be congratulated. But congratulations are cold bedfellows. In the spirit of rebellion always abides a hope of finding rest and surcease in an alternative framework. And such is the nature of the women's movement. Created in opposition to the myth, as a rebellion against it, it seeks in many instances its purification in an alternative mode. The social, economic, and legal consequences of its forces are obvious. Its aesthetic consequences, I believe, are still uncertain. One of the most popular items on the movement agenda, and endlessly discussed, endlessly contradicted, etc., as we all know, is the question of female culture. Does it exist? Should it exist? Should it separately exist? Did it ever exist? Did it ever separately exist? Etc. According to the verse stars, folk singers, and the amateur archaeologists, the answer is always a resounding yes, and the great mother goddess is once more celebrated. And thus in the popular imagination has grown a notion of a lesbian aesthetic.